way past midnight, and you still couldn't fall asleep. This night the dream was leaving, she tried so hard to keep. And with the new day's dawning, she felt it drifting away. Not only for a cruise, not only for a day. Too long ago, too long apart, she couldn't wait another day for the captain of her heart.
Talk with George Norrie. Call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And with our special guest tonight, David Brown. And of course, this hour, it's for you. It's your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. David, what was this rumor about a mummy's curse on the Titanic?
I don't know where that started. The story is so good that you hardly want to let the facts get in the way of the truth. But the idea was that there was a mummy being stolen from Egypt and shipped on the Titanic to America to a buyer for some reason wanted a mummy. Anyway, it was supposed to be some Egyptian royalty, and it had a curse on it. The Titanic sank. Now, the story gets really interesting because the full story is that then the mummy was transferred to a lifeboat. They didn't have room for people, but they did for a mummy. The mummy was landed and then eventually shipped back to England a few years later aboard the Lusitania.
Oh, my God.
it's a great story.
It is a great story. It's a movie all by itself.
Yeah. As near as I can tell, I wouldn't count on any truth to it at all.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, where are you calling from, sir?
This is Bill from Detroit.
Ah, the old hometown for both of us, David.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bill.
First off, you mentioned the gentleman in the who dressed to go down like a gentleman. It was Benjamin Guggenheim, and he
That's
did so
correct.
First off because he did not know how to swim. That was the most important thing. He did not know how to swim, and he knew he had no chance. Second, I'm just curious about some of the facts that you've come up with as far as the length of time the rear of the ship stayed afloat, where you got the facts.
Yeah, actually, if you're in the area, come on down to Vermilion, Ohio on Saturday and join us. We're having a roundtable discussion at the museum. The Great Lakes Historical Society. He's in Detroit. I'd like to invite him. But what I did is I've spent about 5 years putting together a chronology, and it now runs about, 700 different entries. And I used the stopped pocket watches of various people to ascertain that at about 1:55, the bow section or the front of the boat deck at the bridge went under, and that's fairly well documented with Thayer's watch, Gracie's watch, Weichmann's watch, postal clerk March, and there's somebody else I can't remember. And that's when the breakup is taking place also. And it basically, it's all tied together. So the breakup starts at that point. The people start running aft. And the bow is effectively gone once the breakup takes part because it has water filling from both ends now. So the bow disappears rather quickly. The stern, however, floated for some period of time. One of the problems in this is timing, and I don't want to try and explain it because we really don't have a whole lot of time, but I understanding there's a 24 or 23 minute disjuncture in various timings of things, but the result is that about I figure that that's about 2:20 on April 14th time on what I call wheelhouse time. That's about 1:55, and that's the time that the striking of the iceberg was measured in. It's hard to say when the stern actually disappeared, but probably I give it about 2:20 just to keep a symmetry to the thing.
Do you think they'll ever raise the ship, David?
Can't be done.
No way.
But I have talked with the man who's in charge of it for NOAA, and I'm trying to think. His first name is Jeremy, and I can't think of his last name. I'm embarrassed. They are basically patrolling the Titanic right now by satellite. If you go out there and steam past, they won't pay any attention. But if on two or three passes of the satellite you're right over top of it and haven't moved, they'll send somebody out to visit you.
How much treasure do you think went down with the ship?
Good question. It was common in that era for international banking was done in specie or gold. And they would ship large amounts of gold back and forth. I mean, they had gold bars that were that just did nothing, I guess, but go back and forth across the ocean. And it would be very unusual if Titanic didn't have some of that, but it was never shown on the manifest or anything because there was some secrecy about it. But whether there's any there or not, I don't know.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Where are you calling from?
Dayton, Ohio.
Okay, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I sent you a Fast Blast earlier talking about with the number of survivors, you were talking about the number of survivors in the water, and I believe that number is 9. But that's just a figure that I remember. But the real reason was I believe that I've actually died on the Titanic and now live. Now, I am your normal college student, nothing abnormal about me. It's just one of those things, you know?
You think you reincarnated from there?
Yes. It's one of those. As a child, I became obsessed with learning about the Titanic, and child, I mean from like 13 into my late teen years. And right about whenever the movie came out, well, before then, I was having, like, reoccurring dreams of being on a boat, water swirling, everything like that, and then tied in with my obsession with the Titanic. I mean, at one point in time, I knew exactly how many rivets were in the boat. That's how obsessed I was with knowing everything about the Titanic.
Well, you know, it's funny, because I've known a couple young kids. One used to play with one of my daughters. Obsessed, like you must have been, with the Titanic. I mean, he read everything at an age of like 8 years old. so you know what? I don't rule anything out anymore. David, have you come across anybody who thinks as she does?
There are a fair number of them, yes. And within the group of serious Titanic researchers, those people are sometimes, and I think improperly, shunned a bit. Although some of them can be a little difficult to deal with. But when somebody really believes it, I don't want to say no. I mean, because I can't prove it one way or the other.
You can't say no. How many people died?
Call it 1,500.
1,500. So
yeah.
There could be 1,500 souls out there somewhere.
Do you have any idea which person you think you were?
Well, years ago, whenever they brought up the one piece of the hull, and they were touring around with some artifacts brought up from the Titanic. They had the exhibit in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I went down with a couple friends, and at the beginning of the exhibit, it's really cool because they give you a ticket that's a replica of what a passenger would have had with a passenger's name on it. And you go through the entire exhibit, and I was looking down at that name, and I'm like, yeah, okay, fine, whatever. And went through the exhibit. I mean, they had the piece of the hull hanging there, which was just absolutely gorgeous and chilling at the exact same time. And then walking through and seeing all these letters that never made it to their destinations. And then at the very end of the exhibit, there's this huge wall with every single passenger on there. And all these survivors were bolded and all the fatalities were italicized. And you're supposed to find the name on your ticket on that wall. And I was just browsing through. I had a second class passenger ticket, but I was looking through the third class. My eyes hit a name. I don't even remember what it was. And I just started crying, and I could not stop myself. I had to sit down. I don't even remember the name. And after that, my obsession with the Titanic stopped. It was like that moment of complete closure. It was just one of those moments. Yeah, it's hard to explain.
I'll tell you, you're explaining two things to me that I find interesting about Titanic. First of all, you're one of the very few people who apparently ties to a third-class person and someone who was what we would, you know, look at in the movie as a nobody, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's unusual. Usually everybody's, you know, it's funny, people get reincarnated as generals and queens and, you know, but the other thing that I find interesting is she's describing this romantic attachment to the ship and that people have, and it is almost mystical.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks, and whoever you may be, but that's a great story, and like you said, David, you can't rule it out.
I'm not going to, because I can't prove it one way or the other, and that's, you know, without proof, I'll just say she told her story.
Let's go to East of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good.
I hope I'm not off topic here. My great-grandfather went down on a ship called the USS Cyclops.
Really?
Yes. He
in the Bermuda Triangle.
Yes, and I've done some research. My grandfather talked about it at length when I was little and growing up, and I've become a little more obsessed with it here lately. And he was a Navy captain and then got out of the service, then went back in, was called up in the reserves during World War One, became the boatswain, or I'm not sure how you pronounce it.
Well, it's spelled boatswain. It's pronounced bosun.
Oh, bosun.
Bosun. Yeah, you got to slur everything.
Okay. And that's what he... That was his duty on that ship, even though he was a pretty much decorated Navy captain back in the day, and then he was called up in the reserves, and that was his first mission when he went back in, and then my grandfather talked about how we never heard from him again and all that, and I didn't know, I was wondering what you knew about that. I guess it's one of the big Navy mysteries and about what happened to it, and I also didn't know for sure what his duties would be as the boatswain, or how you pronounce it.
You know, I'm not really sure of what his duties would have been on that ship, but it's sort of the senior member of the crew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's and usually is they have a couple of them, and one is in charge of one watch, and the other in charge of the other. You know, and so that sort of thing, and they're very important people because generally, they know more about what's going on and what's right and wrong than the captain does. As far as what happened to the Cyclops, aside from knowing that it's a ship that disappeared in the Bermuda Triangle, I haven't researched it too much. It was a collier, and coal fires and coal bunker fires and things are a problem with those ships.
Right.
They also produce coal vents off what they called... damp fire, I think it was. Anyway, it's a gas that's quite explosive, and so there are a lot of things can happen to a ship that's loaded with coal, which means that there may not be a mystery to the mystery if you knew what the answer was to the mystery. You know,
right.
May have a very simple and solution, but nonetheless, it is a mysterious sinking.
Yeah, I wound up with my grandmother, after my grandfather died, gave me a trunk, and inside the trunk were his Navy dress blues, and I have his Navy dress jacket and slacks and all that stuff. It's very eerie knowing what happened, and I've got all kinds of pictures and all that, but the Cyclops part of it is just, you know, kind of out there, and it's all over the Internet, but nobody really knows anything, so.
There's some fascinating stories about the captain of the Cyclops.
Yeah, I guess he was kind of weird and almost mutinous, as a matter of fact. It's hard to say.
Captains get a reputation.
Yes, exactly.
And he might have just been one of those people with a personality that everybody liked talking about.
Okay, well, I really appreciate it. I've been trying to research it.
To hear the story.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for being part of the program. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on the air with Dave Brown. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes.
Hello, Dave. This is your favorite Martian from Wickenburg, Arizona, David.
That's right. Hello, Martian Dave.
Hey, Dave, what is the problem with the rescue with the Carpathian? Is that the only ship that was in the area, or was it because of they didn't have enough enough ships with radios in those days, or...
And that was like 50-some miles away at the time, wasn't it?
Well, actually, it was less away. That's an interesting point, because the ship was actually closer to the Carpathia, Titanic was, than what the CQD, or distress messages, were sent out. The Carpathia was the closest ship that was not in the, you know, that was not trapped by ice or prevented by ice from getting to the Titanic, save one. And the Carpathia was also the only ship. It was a passenger vessel and therefore had capacity to handle a large number of people. So it was the logical rescue ship. There is, of course, the other ship in the story, and that's the Californian. And the Californian was north of Titanic. And I'm going to be really vague here, and the reason is because I don't really want to get into an argument forever on this. Or we stir up the Californian debate, and we'll never get off the air. But basically, the British report said that Captain Lord of the Californian paid no attention to the distress rockets of Titanic. The radio operator on Californian was off duty, so they never heard the distress calls on the radio, and Californian slept while the Titanic sank. There are people who will fight you, you know, to the death that he didn't do that, but he has gone down in history as the man who slept through the sinking of the Titanic.
Interesting. Next up, Wild Card Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, David.
Good morning.
I was just wondering, you know, that scene in the Titanic, this is Tab Webmaster from Fantastic Four.
Oh, hi, Tab.
That scene on the movie The Titanic, where the third class passengers get locked below the intentionally locked below decks, was there any truth to that?
Kathy Akers Jordan, up in she's in Michigan near Detroit, did a very extensive study. The kind of gate that people were supposedly trapped behind is called a Bostwick gate. Most high schools have them across corridors in the United States where they're like an accordion gate. They used to use them on elevators, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
There were Bostwick gates on the Titanic, but we can't find any that would have prevented passengers from going where they needed to go to get to the boat deck. They just weren't put in those places. What is probably true, more so than gates, it was against U.S. law for immigrants coming in, going to Ellis Island to mingle with first and second class passengers. They had to be segregated. So Titanic did that very nicely. There were ways for the third class to go up to the boat deck, but they were not, you know, obvious. And the reason was they weren't supposed to go there. So I think that's more what happened. I have another theory, and I hate to do this, but it's based on something I was given under embargo and I can't talk about.
Now, what do you mean you can't talk about it?
Oh,
you know me, Dave.
Somebody, and I'm a man of my word. But I don't think there were any gates like that. Now, there were some gates on some stairways that went exterior ladders that go up from the third class to the boat deck area or to first class areas, and those would have been closed. And I do believe that where there's smoke, there's fire, and if what I have, frankly, I'm not even sure I would be telling you something that's
subscribe
true.
To the app.
Okay, well, we're going to take this quick break. I think that was God telling us to go to it now.
Okay.
Stay with us. Tab, thanks for the call.
Want to time travel? Go back to past shows on Streamlink. Sign up online at coasttocoastam.com.
Chippewa on down at the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early. The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned. Concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland. Then later that night when the ship's bell rang, could it be the north wind they'd been feeling?
To talk with George Norrie, call the wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
On our next Coast to Coast program, our guest will be Stephen Quayle. Lucifer's Luggage, Suitcase Nukes in America, that's the topic. Back with the rest of your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. During that time period, David, what did it cost for like a first-class parlor suite to go on the Titanic?
You know, I do have that in my file, but I don't have it in front of me. I have to pass on that one if you don't mind.
Okay.
But it was the equivalent of you know, a year's wages for some of the workers.
Oh, my.
You know, for some of those suites.
So pretty expensive.
Yeah, if you wanted to to get that parlor suite, the famous one, yes. They ranged on down. Don't forget the third class people. Well, they weren't necessarily dirt poor. I mean, a lot of them had a lot of money with them because they came to this country, went out to Kansas or Iowa or someplace and bought a farm. But they didn't want to spend money on a ship. So the third class cabins were relatively inexpensive by comparison. The interesting thing is, though, that a lot of people think that third class paid the freight, and that's not true. The majority of the income from passenger tickets came from first class.
Wildcard Line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
How you doing? This is Scott from Lewis, Delaware.
Hi, Scott.
Home of Calmar Nickel.
Absolutely. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing? Yesterday, I heard a little thing on Paul Harvey about the sixth worst maritime loss of life, not during a wartime. It was a ship that was tied to dock somewhere in the United States on a river.
You're talking about the Eastland, rolled over. And 800, I think it's about 835 or 850 people, mostly women and children, died. It was a very tender ship. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yes. Yes. I was just. I only heard a little bit of it, so I was just wondering if you knew basically what had happened.
The Eastland was a ship that was very tender. That is, it rolled easily and had a tendency of doing some rather nasty rolls that people questioned its safety, actually. But nobody did anything about it. And then as time went on, for instance, the Titanic plays into the Eastland. After the Titanic, they passed laws requiring all these lifeboats be installed. The problem is that the weight balance of the Eastland was never designed to carry that much weight. So you that much weight of lifeboats. So you have additional boats, additional weight topside. And they loaded a bunch of, they were the wives and children of the American, Western Electric company in Chicago, and they loaded them for a company picnic, and the ship started to roll. No one to this day really knows why. It took much longer than you would think to roll over, several minutes. But the people, once it started to go, the people kind of piled up inside, couldn't get out. More than 800, mostly women and children, died. And the ship was still tied up to the side of the river, the Chicago River, right downtown.
David, I'm confused about Eleanor Schumann, who they say was the inspiration for Kate Winslet's Rose. She dies at the age of 87 in 1998. That would have made her 1 year old on the Titanic. How could they create a love story like that? I mean, so something's wrong.
Hey, you can do anything with movies.
Ah, are you telling me that didn't happen? How disappointing.
Yeah, Jack and Kate, actually, what happened to the Titanic is Jack and Kate went through running around, opening all those doors, letting the water go, you know? That's what happened.
Well, how could they put this down as a statistic that she was the inspiration for the movie if she was 1 year old at the time?
You know, it's getting late over here in this part of the world, and it strikes me that she did either went out to the site or something and may even have gone down in one of the submersibles. Anyway, there was something about, you know, the old lady going back to the ship kind of thing.
That I could understand, but I don't think the old lady was...
You have to have a willing suspension of disbelief. You know, there was no door from the boiler room into the hold where the car was either. And by the way, the car was in a crate. So, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, you have to have that ability to accept what they present.
Let's go to some more callers. First time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Bob from Detroit.
Hey, Bob, go ahead, sir.
I've listened to most of the program tonight. I didn't get a chance to listen to all of it. Several things I didn't hear about that I'm curious about was as far as vision perception and distance of the iceberg. I've read in several books that the binoculars were missing from the crow's nest.
That's
information
correct.
On that? And possibly how that could feed into maybe the iceberg not being seen at 6 to 8 minutes, as you said earlier, because they didn't have binoculars available. Another thing I was curious about, I didn't hear anything about, I don't have the designations down properly. You said something about a bulkhead giving way and that causing a great problem as the ship was flooding. I've read in pretty much every book I've ever read on the subject that the major problem which caused one of the bulkheads to fail was none of the watertight bulkheads reached the surface of the ship to seal off completely.
Let me answer those two. First of all, on the binoculars, when you're training a lookout, binoculars are never used to search. Binoculars are used to identify. The human eye is much better at spotting things unaided. Secondly, especially at night, because binoculars focus the light on your color receptors, which are much less able to see than the black and white receptors around your peripheral vision. So at night, you learn to sweep your eyes so that you're looking with your peripheral vision. It's a little trick that it takes some learning, but that's what you do. And then when you find something, you use the binoculars to identify it. So binoculars being missing from the crow's nest, probably not an issue, particularly since the binoculars, the British binoculars of 1912 were not coated optics, and they would actually have seen less than the human eye. As far as the bulkhead thing, I haven't been able to find one scintilla of evidence that water overflowed any bulkheads until the ship was effectively lost. This business of the ice cube tray flooding that you see everybody does, as far as I can see, it is pure myth. The water came up through the bottom, and in fact, it came up in boiler room number 4, which was not theoretically not touched by the iceberg. I have a theory on that as to why it did, and it has to do with the nature of the accident. But the water came up through boiler room number 4. The water came horizontally through boiler room number 5. It came up in boiler room number 6. It came up in hold number 3, up in hold number 2, and up in hold number 1. Nobody saw water overtopping the bulkheads until after the ship was flooded to the point it couldn't be saved. That, I think, is another one of Titanic's myths, and I don't think they wanted to talk about what really happened. It was easier just to pass that off than talk about the perhaps structural problems in the ship, you know, that, or what might be perceived as structural problems. I'm not entirely sure that you could build a ship stronger than Titanic, but that would be what would appear when it got in the hands of lawyers in court.
How close was the ship to New York City when it went down?
It's a little over 1,000 miles, 600 miles to Halifax.
So they had a poke. That was a long way to go. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast, it's your turn. Hi there.
Yeah, good morning, George, or good evening, wherever the case may be.
You got that right.
Walt from Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Sure, listening
to you on 850 WNTJ.
Go ahead, Walt. Good to have you
on. All right. Say good morning to your guest there. My question is, actually, I have a couple quick questions there. What would have happened if the Titanic would have hit that iceberg head on instead of trying to swerve around it? Do you think it might have been a different
circumstance? Basically, it didn't try to swerve around it. That's the thing. If you look at the evidence, the nature of the damage, you look at what the lookouts actually said happened and sorted out by the minute, there was no attempt to dodge the iceberg. The problem was, by the time that Murdoch realized what was going on, it was too late to maneuver. So it did aim straight at it. Frankly, if it had been maneuvering, the damage would have been worse. It would have been further aft. I don't think the ship would have survived anywhere near as long as it did.
If you were going to be able to change anything in that movie, David, what would you have changed?
Probably nothing. And I know that sounds funny, but I can't argue with success. Jim Cameron knew what he was doing. He produced a movie that guys like to watch and girls like to go to, and that's ideal. And so I don't think I would change anything. I just don't think it's a very accurate portrayal of the real ship. But I don't have any problem with that.
Okay, let's go to our next caller. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, you calling for me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, I had two questions. First, you talk about the watches and the time of being approximately 1:55, was it?
Yes.
Is there anything testing-wise that you've done based off the thickness of the glass, the type of the watch, based off water pressure, not necessarily based off the time that the ship broke up, knowing that they didn't make these, you know, these fine diving watches, you know, back
no,
then.
The watches of 1912, I've talked with somebody who, obviously I can't get my hands on any of them. I mean, you know, they're rather valuable, and I'm not going to try to be honest with you and say that I know that much about watches, but I did talk with somebody about the watches of 1912, and obviously if the water got into them, they would likely stop. Well, they wouldn't likely stop. They would stop. The other thing which surprised me is that the person I talked to, the jeweler I talked to, said it was very likely that thermal shock would stop a lot of the less expensive watches in particular. That is just, you know, the exposure to the cold before the water got in them could cause them to stop. But it appears that most of them were stopped by water, and they seem to, the ones that I've been able to find information on, all tally to the same time, and they're all people who we can place at the forward end of the boat deck. So I have to go with what I've got, but I think it's pretty accurate.
Second question is, Bob Ballard, I had a chance to meet him, not necessarily talk to him, not that I'd even like to talk to him, but when he claims that he found the Titanic, he was using, to my knowledge, U.S. Navy equipment, the sonar fishes from NAVO at the Space Center down in Mississippi. And NAVO may have already located the Titanic. This is some information that I received when I used to work down there several years ago.
Okay, I do not know for certain because I'm not privy to what the Navy does, and I'm not privy to Bob Ballard's, you know, what he does. I have heard the same thing. He has admitted that in some part the Titanic trip was a cover story for some other work he was doing for the Navy. It is also well known that the U.S. and British navies had tried to map all of the wrecks, the iron wrecks, down at the bottom in order to deprive the Russian submarines of places to hide from sonar. So whether or not the rumor on the street is that when he couldn't find it, somebody telegraphed him to look at a certain area. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but what he did do is he went down, he identified it, he photographed it, and he brought it back to us for the first time, and for that, he gets credit for finding. It's kind of like Christopher Columbus. He ran into a continent. You couldn't miss it, but we say, you know, he discovered the New World. First guy gets the credit.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, appreciate you being on the program. Couple more moments to go, so we'll take as many calls as we can. West of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Doug from Los Angeles.
Hey, Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, I read a book a couple of years ago, and it had a chapter on the Titanic, and it was talking about the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 that was signed Christmas Eve when most of the Senate was out, that gave the power of the U.S. dollar into the hands of the international bankers.
True.
And it was telling in there that, and Woodrow Wilson, president, when he signed it, he said, "I've ruined America." And it was telling the story about the four main millionaires that were killed on the Titanic refused to sign this bill. And they were approached in 1910 about it. So there's like a pre-1912, and they wouldn't go along with it. And ironically, they all perished on the Titanic. And the chapter more or less said that this was like a kamikaze barge that was built to lure these guys on because Captain Smith was retiring. This was his last voyage, and he'd gone through these waters a million times, and there was ice all over, and he ignored to go further south when there was ice floes, and I mean less ice floes and everything. And it was almost like he deliberately just, you know, smashed up, and it was telling Fats about that there was... This shouldn't have happened unless they deliberately almost set this up.
Strange coincidence, David? What do you think?
Well, first of all, I have never studied the Federal Reserve Act with regards to the millionaires on Titanic, so I won't comment on that. He may be right. I don't know. As far as what Captain Smith did, I'm finding evidence that he was operating well within the parameters of 1912, the ordinary practice of seamen. He actually apparently did want to go a little bit south that day. He was on the bridge, and it's a myth that he was asleep. He was actually in the chart room, and he was actively plotting the positions of ice that night. I think there's a lot of myth there. What happened to Titanic, as near as I can see, is good men doing their best, but as I say, they lost situational awareness. The situation got out of hand, and they didn't know it. They did their best. I can't fault them. Obviously, you have to say that as Captain Smith has the blame for it, or the responsibility, I should say, but I don't like to blame anyone. Responsibility is one thing, blame being another, and I think he would stand here and say he was responsible for the accident, but I don't think anybody deliberately set it up. And the other thing is, I don't know how you would damage a ship deliberately to sink it in the manner that it actually came off. I mean, that's a crime called barratry, and it'd be hard to find a sailor who would do it.
Well, David, we are out of time, but the two books we've been talking about tonight based on our interview, White Hurricane and The Last Log of the Titanic, where do you get it?
Any of the major bookstores, online, it's available all over.
All right, David, I got to tell you, it was a treat talking to you after so many years.
Yes.
Again,
we'll
to people.
We'll get together again sometime in another 26 years or whatever.
We worked hand in hand about 26 years ago.
Yeah.
Long time, huh? Do I still sound the same?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I think you got better looking and I got older.
Yeah, but you got richer.
No, oh no, one of us made good.
David, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Good luck.
Take care. Thank you.
David Brown. Yeah, we worked together in Detroit at the same television station, and at that time he was always interested in boats and shipping, and little did I know his whole career would go in that direction as well. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, and of course Dave Caprita, who helped us today. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.